Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Ryan Lehrer, and my next guest wants us to rethink competition, at least in the modern sense of that word. She's written a new book. It's called A Bigger Prize, and it turns the modern notion of success on its head to deconstruct the competitive model and propose something she says will be much more effective. Margaret Heffernan joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, it's nice to be talking to you.
So, first things first, why do you call this book A Bigger Prize?
Well, I think that in our businesses and in society as a whole, we've become extremely focused on the notion that we each want our own prize. I think that has cost us enormously. And I think it may mean that occasionally we get little scraps of rewards, but what we're missing out is the bigger prize, which is more sustainable, long-term, collective, shared success.
Well, now, I have to admit I enjoyed the book enormously, but I also had a really hard time with it because I, Margaret, really like competition. And you say in the book that competition is counterproductive, and that's your word, not mine.
Yep.
And I think you even use the word perverse. You can tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but I don't think I am. And you're not just talking about business. You're talking about society, American society, and other competitive societies as
right.
a whole. So explain that. Break that down for us a bit.
Sure. Well, economists talk about perverse outcomes when they look at situations in which competition doesn't work. And part of my argument is, that makes it sound like it's some kind of anomaly, whereas, in fact, I would say we're always going to get perverse outcomes when we enter into a system which necessarily says there are going to be a few winners and lots of losers. I mean, to my mind, that is predictably perverse. I think everybody's competitive, and up to a point, I think that's absolutely fine. I think, games are fun. Sports should be fun, though they pretty much aren't anymore. I think a competition can make really mundane, boring jobs temporarily enlivened. But my argument is that from the school system to elite sports to business cultures, the dog-eat-dog mindset is profoundly and disproportionately destructive. I think when you look at the educational failure, the commercial failures, the business scandals, the economic collapse, you can find the heart of competition beating strongly within those. Mm. And while competition may have allowed us on the early days of our history to make advances, I would argue that it's now pretty much undermining our chances of success in the future.
You even talk about the family unit.
Yeah.
So let's break all of these down a bit. I love the part about sports, but let's talk about family first. And you look at sibling rivalry.
Yeah. Well, I did that for several reasons, partly because it's such a common theme. But also because I think that families should be a place in which we really learn to tackle these very rivalrous feelings that we all have, because families should be a place where we learn to do conflict well. And I think in really creative, successful families, people find their own roles as a way to escape constant competition. So one of the families that I talk about is the Nader family, where each kid took a different part of the world to become expert in.
Mm-hmm.
So between all of them, they had the globe covered. Very clever, way of kind of keeping people's motivation and drive up without having them beat each other up and have to compete for success around the dinner table. In very, I think, desperately sad families, competition is actively stoked by parents. It certainly was in my father's family. And from those families, you see kids emerge who have to win in every encounter. Mm. And statistically, these people do very badly in later life, mostly because nobody really wants to work with them. But, you know, largely because their competitiveness, which I definitely saw in my own father, is so isolating. Mm. If somebody's more successful than you, you can't stand it. And if they're less successful than you, then what's the point of spending time with them? So really, you're left with nobody but yourself.
Mm. And that is terribly sad.
It's sad, but it's also fantastically counterproductive because, you know, in real life, you really can't do anything on your own.
No. So few of us can. I mean, maybe one or two very wealthy philanthropists. That's about it.
Yeah, but, you know, even they, you know, they can't find the right people, find the right projects, connect with the right projects. If they all they can ever do in those exchanges is try to win.
Right. Well, okay. I can see it in the family, but let's talk about sports. How are we supposed to have sports without competition?
Well, so I think, I mean, it's really interesting. I'm so glad you brought this up because this is one of my favorite parts of the book, which is...
Mine too.
I think sports are great. But Travis Tygart, who runs the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, did some brilliant research which revealed a really paradoxical quality to our attitude about sports, which is we all love sports because it teaches fairness, integrity, collaboration, dealing with failure, all of the things that we admire and need in life. But when you ask people, but what matters in sport, overwhelmingly they say the same thing, winning.
Yeah.
And the consequence of that is that by the age of 12, 80% of kids have dropped out of doing any sport because they see they can't win. And if winning is all that it's about, and you can't win, why bother? Mm. And Tygart has launched, I think, this really, really impressive campaign to try to get us back to what he calls true sport, which is engaging in sport for fun. And when you do it for fun, it teaches all those great lessons and it keeps us healthier and so on. But once it becomes too intense and too competitive, which really all elite sports now are, it actually drives people away.
Mm. And that is one of my favorite parts of the book. But let
me
then ask... Then let
I mean,
me
I
ask,
think Tygart's an absolute star.
And the true sports, that is a brilliant revelation.
I mean, I think it shows great insight. But, mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing that his true sport research showed was the incredibly high levels of cheating in sport by parents and parents on behalf of their kids.
And of course, we know about
the direction we want to go.
And we know about all of the cheating by the athletes themselves. But then let me ask you, Margaret, about school. Why is it we don't want people to cheat in school either? But why is it a bad thing, or at least not constructive, I think is the way you put it, to celebrate the kid who's at the top of the class?
Well, because it demotivates everybody else. So if you want a school system that has one or two cherry-picked superstars and you're happy for everybody else to fail, that's great. But what you'll find around the world is that those are not the characteristics of the high-achieving educational system. And furthermore, those people may do very well in these highly structured tests, but when you then expose them to the extreme uncertainty and volatility of real life, there's absolutely no reason to believe that these people are going to do well.
Hmm. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Margaret Heffernan, and we're talking about her new book, A Bigger Prize. Margaret, of course, also wrote another extremely well-regarded book, Willful Blindness. So, Margaret, what are you proposing in the alternative to competitiveness? If we're not competitive, what should we be?
Well, I think if you go back, to what we were saying about education, I think it's really striking that they high-achieving educational systems are very dedicated at making everybody succeed, not just picking the winners. I would say the same is true in really creative, productive science labs. I think I demonstrate it's a salient characteristic of the most successful companies, whether we're talking Ocean Spray, whether we're talking Eileen Fisher, whether we're talking Arup, the structural engineers, you know, these incredibly sustainable, creative, innovative businesses are all driven by an ethos which is about how do we succeed in a way where everybody benefits, not just the privileged few? How do we internally develop habits and the mindset for really fruitful collaboration, which is, you know, muscular and energetic? It's not an easy option. But when we are all driven to improve each other's work. And I think, you know, one of the great revelations to me was this notion that success is about kind of heroic soloists is hugely personified, I think, in our culture by things like, talent shows and America's Got Talent and things like that. And what was really interesting was digging into the truth behind all of this and discovering that the great artists in music or in theater or in filmmaking are the ones that are great collaborators. They're the ones who suck in all the other talent that other talent really wants to work with. It's not the huge egos. It's the talents that bring out the best in other talents. And I think that's a really important mental model for us to start thinking about, because the superstars actually empty the space of ideas and possibilities. And they're absolutely not at the heart of successful careers or indeed, I would argue, successful businesses.
Let's take a call, Margaret, from Joan on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Joan, you are on WNYC with my guest, Margaret Heffernan, who's written a new book called A Bigger Plan.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Please go right ahead.
Oh, yes, yes. I wanted
a
to...
A Bigger Prize is her new book, A Bigger Prize.
Hello?
Yes, please
hi,
go
Jen.
Ahead.
Yes, hi. I want to support the point that your guest is making. Many years ago when I was in college, I studied the Zuni Indians. My professor was an expert on them. They are a tribe of Indians in New Mexico. And they had, in the entire history of their tribe, and I assume he knew how to verify this and validate this, they had no history of suicide or murder ever in their tribe. And another thing they didn't have was competition. And in terms of how this worked in school, it was very interesting. When the Zuni children went to the European American schools, they never raised their hand, and the teacher thought, well, they just don't know the answers. And one day she called on one of them, and he had the answer. And she said, well, why didn't you raise your hand? He said, we don't do that. We wait until everyone has the answer. And, you know, the idea of preempting, you know, the contrast to the American schools where someone has their hand up in the air the second they have the answer. They give the answer, and then no one else has the motivation to come up with it. They apparently feel it's less important who does it faster and more important that everyone know how to do it, and they'll have a stronger community. So they just wait patiently, and they respect each other. And I think there's a connection between that and the fact that they have no suicide and no murder. Mm.
Joan, it sounds like A Bigger Prize is the book for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And Margaret, in researching this book, you didn't just pull this out of thin air. You researched this by traveling the bogs of Massachusetts, and you went to Singapore and Finland. And as you noted earlier, you have found examples here in the U.S. of successful companies and organizations who are using creative cooperative ways to work instead of the traditional competitive model.
Right.
So the Zuni tribe she mentions has been modeled in many places that you you studied and researched for this book and that you write about in this book, A Bigger Prize.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, going to Singapore where, you know, and the Singaporeans will tell you, you know, that they're very competitive people. And they have a very successful education system, which many commentators have assumed must be successful because of its competitiveness. And yet, you know, there's a lot of soul searching going on there about really how do we make our people more collaborative and better able to work together, because there's an absolute recognition that if they don't do that, the country's in real trouble. That actually, as the world becomes more globalized, our ability to work with different kinds of people and to get the best out of them rather than to one-up them is going to be fundamental both to our social and our economic success. And I think, you know, it's people very quickly think, I'm either talking about going back to the Soviet Union, which is absolutely not the
case.
Completely
different.
It was one of the most competitive places in societies on Earth. Or they think that collaboration is just sitting around and agreeing with each other. And in fact, it's absolutely spectacularly the opposite of that, in the sense that really great collaborations are very fierce, very energetic, and they're based on the notion that everybody brings their best, that that's how you honor each other, is with, you know, real candor and openness and thoughtfulness about what will make other people's work better.
Yeah.
And so I think collaboration is a really tough thing to do well. And many of the companies I work with are struggling to figure out how to make their departments or their business units or whatever much more collaborative. And they're discovering, you know, that this is as far from soft or easy as it's possible to get.
Yes, and I think if they read this book, they should read to the end, because you have a secret to success in true collaboration, and there are some key qualities. But I'm not going to give them away, because that would be a spoiler. I commend that everybody. I was going to ask you to tell us, but then people wouldn't need to read the book. They should read the book.
Well, also, I think there are lots of great examples
yes.
in my books of,
yes.
of people and organizations that do it well.
Yes.
But I also think that then you have to go and kind of retrain yourself.
Yes, we all have to.
In terms of the kinds of questions you ask, the kinds of listening you do, the kinds of people that you put together into teams, or the kinds of teams that you yourself contribute to.
Well, reading
you can only really learn this stuff, not by reading the recipe, but,
right.
you know, baking the cake.
Reading the book is only the first step. And my guest
yeah.
has been Margaret Heffernan. She is an entrepreneur, a chief executive, and an author. And this book is a bigger prize. I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, Jamie. Thank you.
Coming up next, spring is here, and so too are the birders. So bird watchers, get set to call in with your best spot, best sighting, or best story of bird watching in our listening area. 212-433-9692. Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Be right back.